With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. The last day to submit applications for America's Farmland Trust 2023 cohort of the Brighter Future Fund program is coming up this week on July 15th. The program helps farmers across the nation improve farm viability, access, transfer, or permanently protect farmland and adopt regenerative agriculture practices. AFT's Brighter Future Fund provides grants up to $10,000 per project. A project may involve one farmer or more farmers or farm families, and it will be awarded on a one-per-farm basis. If you'd like to find out more information or to submit an application, visit farmland.org. And now let's get into today's show headlines. AB 1016, focusing on drone applicator certification programs, are deemed a win for the ag industry. Not all proposed pesticide bills are favorable for the ag industry, but Anna Genasi of Stanislaus County Farm Bureau gave a thumbs up to Farm Bill-sponsored Assembly Bill 1016.
I think one of the struggles with DPR is sometimes the regulations don't keep up with the innovation of our industry. And so whether you're talking about drones or autonomous tractors or robots or whatever, I am 100% in favor of technology that makes our job smarter, easier, less human interaction with a hazard. So whether it's a moving piece on a piece of equipment or a chemical, I think our industry, I mean, the thing that I brag on our growers all the time is they're adaptive.
Genasi adds,
you know, kudos to California Farm Bureau for getting in front of this and pushing this bill forward.
Stay tuned as we'll have more on this topic in the coming shows. But for right now, here's AgNet West Brian German with back-to-back agricultural reports.
A comprehensive approach using regenerative practices is proving valuable for almond growers. Senior Director of Agronomy at Olam Food Ingredients, Zach Ellis, said that stacking different regenerative practices in their almonds is helping improve orchard conditions as well as cut down on certain costs.
Yeah, miticides are not cheap. I think the only one is abamectin, and that one doesn't really work very well anymore, and it kills all of our six-spotted thrips. So being able to reduce our miticide sprays obviously has a product benefit that we're not purchasing those consumables anymore. You know, I'd also say that we look at our bee health quite extensively, and our mortality rate has gone way down as a result of being better stewards and implementing some of these regenerative practices. We also see less water infiltration issues. We see better nutrient use efficiency. We're able to cut some of our nitrogen a little bit by using compost and by having better use efficiency. And then other things that are pretty easy for growers to do, like increasing their water frequency throughout the week to spread that water out. And then in turn, increasing their fertigation. By doing that, you're able to really see a benefit of how spoon feeding something will net you less usage. And that's really where we're seeing a huge savings.
Both the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives continue to work on their versions of the 2023 Farm Bill. Senior Government Relations Representative for the National Cotton Council, Robbie Minnick, said that industry representatives were able to provide insight during recent hearings held by both the Senate and House Ag subcommittees.
And I think both hearings went very well. It was an opportunity for the industry to engage with the members, lay out its priorities. And the members on both sides asked really good questions about specific priorities, whether it be the marketing loan or the economic adjustment assistance program for textile mills, or just the general need for increasing reference prices and taking away the Stacks PLC prohibition. All those type questions were asked, and it was an opportunity for the industry to lay out why these are important for all facets of the U.S. cotton industry.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
I typically listen here at work
from my desk on my way to work in the morning. When we wake up, it goes on the radio.
I can hear a song and be instantly transported back to a time in my life that I enjoy remembering.
I think that's what I like listening to radio for, is just to stay informed on whether it's news, sports, new music, anything.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, USDA is now taking applications for a program that offers financial assistance to borrowers who in the past may have been discriminated against by USDA. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says USDA is working with cooperator groups.
So we can ensure that the word gets out to all those who believe they've been discriminated against at USDA in farm loans and farm activities, to be able to make sure that they do get the information necessary for the application.
Farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners who experienced discrimination by USDA in its farm loan programs prior to January 1st of 2021 and or are currently debtors with assigned or assumed USDA farm loan debt that was the subject of USDA discrimination that occurred prior to that date are eligible for the program. The application is free and available online. We've put a link on our website, agnetwest.com. Hundreds of dairy industry professionals from around the world will gather in Chicago this fall for the International Dairy Foundation annual conference. The IDF World Dairy Summit is October 16th through the 19th in Chicago. Shauna Morris, the Senior Vice President of Trade Policy for the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council, says the time is right to bring the summit to the U.S.
We had a record year in exports last year. We're very well poised to continue to grow in the years to come. And we're leading on so many of the sustainability fronts that are such an increasing focus for international markets and a lot of the other policymaking developments that our sector globally is working to contend with. Those attending are a pretty broad mix across the dairy industry. Normally, we see farmers, farmer organizations like cooperatives or farmer groups like those I represent on the National Milk Producers and U.S. Dairy Export Council side, a number of processing company representatives too, and then others throughout the supply chain. Take advantage while it's here in our backyard.
She says the summit will feature sessions on a number of topics.
Things like looking at what the situation is of global dairy markets, views on some of the trade issues that are becoming contentious and how to deal with those better. Looking forward, taking a look at how we promote sustainability more effectively to today's global consumers. Also, a number of things at the farm level side, such as how to provide farmers with more supports in advancing sustainability practices, how to make that more commercially effective for them, how to deal with heat stress issues. A lot of those attending are from both developed and developing countries, so it's a bit of a mix of topics to span that full spectrum.
She explains IDF represents the dairy industry around the world.
It's a global organization that's focused on developing science-based standards and guidelines, policy recommendations to help support the production, processing, and trade of dairy products, and also undertaking work to combat the anti-dairy advocates that are so often trying to misuse global institutions, take over government recommendations to advance their anti-dairy agendas. And the major global meeting that organization holds is the World Dairy Summit. It's a conference that takes place typically over 4 days, usually attended by roughly 1,000 people from 40 plus countries around the world. It's taking place during the week of October 16th in Chicago. That's the first time it'll be in the U.S. in 3 decades.
Previous locations for the summit include India and Turkey. In other news from around the nation, the Upper Mississippi River experienced high water conditions due to significant snowfall in the upper Midwest in late winter and early spring. Mike Steenhook of the Soy Transportation Coalition says he was worried about quickly returning to low water levels on the river system even after those high water conditions that resulted from the snowmelt. And that has now unfortunately occurred. He also says it serves as a reminder that drought not only inhibits the ability to grow a crop, but also our ability to transport that crop. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, led by another outstanding month in Mexico, exports of U.S. pork continue to gain momentum in May. That's according to new data released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and compiled by the U.S. Meat Export Federation. As for beef exports that same month, While well below the record large volume and value posted in May of last year, they did improve from April and were the second largest this year behind March. May exports for pork reached over 261,000 metric tons. That's up 16% from a year ago, the ninth largest on record. Export value climbed 12%, also the highest since May of 2021, the seventh highest on record. USMEF President and CEO Dan Holstrom explains how a wide range of markets contributed to the growth in pork exports.
Mexico has been on a record pace all year. That continues in the month of May with growth of 21%. Really hitting on all cylinders is both variety meats as well as hams and shoulder meat and other products going down there from the U.S. But it's not just about Mexico. It's really broad-based growth across the world. You know, China is up 19%, mainly driven by pork variety meats. Korea is up 25% at 21,000 tons for May. And a couple of other markets that we don't talk a lot about that are seeing significant traction, and maybe partly related to the fact that supplies out of Europe are considerably lower than they were a year ago at this time. But we've seen dramatic growth in Australia, mainly on boneless ham muscles being exported from the U.S., up over 200%. Malaysia is up as well, as is Taiwan. So these are some markets that are really contributing to the bottom line that were not in the picture a year ago.
Now, beef exports in May at 116,000 metric ton were down 14% from a year ago, but was up 4% from the previous month. Export value was down 19%, but 2% above April.
We have several headwinds there. Strong U.S. dollar. You've got logistics impacts, which it'll take some time for the logistics to recover once we get the West Coast port contract signed and sealed. Food service has been an underperformer this year. We were hopeful, and we still are hopeful, for a rebound in food service on beef to Asia, but it's definitely been slow in coming.
Now, for January through May, beef and beef variety exports were down 10%. Valued at just over $4 billion. To get a detailed summary of the January through May export results for U.S. beef, pork, and even lamb, you can go to the USMEF website, usmef.org. And last week, a bill was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives called the Exposing Agriculture Trade Suppression, or EATS Act. It's designed to prohibit state and local governments from imposing laws and regulations that have effect of dictating agricultural production practices outside of their borders. The National Pork Producers Council supports this new bill. To learn more about it, go to their website, nppc.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water. Your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
How the USDA is helping poultry producers keep the bird flu from spreading. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA has several informational resources to help poultry producers protect their flocks from highly pathogenic avian influenza. Chief Veterinarian Rosemary Sifford says at the center of the effort is the Defend the Flock educational program.
Lots of activities and information available online to help producers of all types look at their biosecurity, look at their management practices, and help them to learn to use very strong tools to avoid disease introduction of all kind, but particularly high-path avian influenza.
And now new funding is helping to expand informational resources offered by USDA.
We're hoping to also use some of this funding to help us in our preparation and building our capacity to respond to these events through things like some additional biosecurity training and some additional work on developing templates for biosecurity audits.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court clarified that regulatory agencies can't make major policy decisions of national significance through rulemaking. Instead, it's Congress that writes the rules on significant policy decisions. This major questions doctrine has now been invoked to stop the executive branch's attempt to eliminate student loan debt. In 2022, the Supreme Court said the EPA couldn't simply write a rule establishing a regulatory shift in energy production from coal and natural gas electricity generation to wind and solar. Something that significant must go through the Congress, or the Congress must have specifically told the EPA that it could do that. The Congress hadn't, so the court invalidated the rule under the major questions doctrine. Now this doctrine has been used, at least in part, to wipe out the administration's attempt to eliminate over $400 billion in student loan debt. The Congress hadn't granted specific legal authority by statute to the administration to do so. The court's decision reaffirms limitations on administrative agency regulations and executive branch decisions in the absence of explicit congressional authorization when a major issue is involved. When an administrative agency or the executive branch gets into issues of major national significance, it doesn't have the authority to take the matter into its own hands. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
The effort to expand both infrastructure and availability of higher blend biofuels in our nation received a recent boost. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack explained to reporters the latest investments with USDA's Higher Blends Infrastructure Incentive Program, which include
$25 million of awards, 59 investments in all across 15 states.
This is the first tranche of funding awards within a $50 million allocation to HBIP made last December. The secretary illustrates how projects might look like on the ground level through an HBIP award recipient.
Northern Fuel Convenience, we're going to receive a $2.2 million grant under this program. Are excited about the opportunity to install 22 E15 dispensers, 15 B20 dispensers, 10 ethanol storage tanks, and 13 biodiesel storage tanks at 10 fueling stations across Minnesota.
And starting this month, applications are being accepted for an additional $450 million in HBIP grant monies.
We are expecting to make available the first tranche of $90 million from that remaining $450 million. And for each quarter thereafter, we will announce an additional $90 million in available resources. So from July 1, 2023 to September 30th, 2024, we will be basically making all $450 million available for applications.
The first round of $90 million funding allocations is broken down into three focus areas.
One bucket, you'll see roughly $67.5 million, will be focused on fueling stations, stations that provide fuel either for cars and trucks, but also for rail and marine as well. Another $18 million is going to be made available for fuel distribution centers and industries and facilities for expanded opportunity there, and $4.5 million for home heating oil distribution.
Secretary Vilsack adds, within the scope of HBIP, assistance options are being explored for small-scale distribution systems, gas stations, and convenience stores.
Those who have 10 or fewer stations, their federal share of the grant will go from 50% of the cost of the infrastructure to 75%, or $5 million. And the goal here is ultimately to make distribution available for fuels that are greater than the 10% ethanol that is readily available, so that's E15, E85, as well as something above the 5% biodiesel that's available, expanding that percentage as well.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Some grain traders wonder about the accuracy in numbers tomorrow in USDA crop report, and the earnings season kicks off on Wall Street. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report brought to you by Helena Agri. USDA releases the July crop report tomorrow. Traders who questioned the surprise adjustment in the soybean acres report on June 30th wonder if supply demand and production numbers tomorrow might also come into question. But beyond the report, we see improving conditions in the weekly update, maybe a one-week affair, with heat returning this week and even more next week. Looking at December corn, needs to hold the 485-490 level in our view this week. November soybeans should get good support around that 1315-1317 level. And September, Kansas City wheat, 815-818. This is the bottom line report. A week from today is the Helena Agri Innovation Expo in Memphis, Tennessee. Be the first to hear about new technology for your crops. Contact your local Helena rep for VIP tickets. Second quarter earnings report beginning on Wall Street. A heavy emphasis early on here on banks and financial institutions. Most major agricultural stocks report later in the month, but most ag equipment and pharmaceutical companies are expected to meet or beat expectations. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Shauna Morris, Senior Vice President of Trade Policy for the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council, says the IDF represents the dairy industry around the world.
It's a global organization that's focused on developing science-based standards and guidelines, policy recommendations to help support the production, processing, and trade of dairy products, and also undertaking work to combat the anti-dairy advocates that are so often trying to misuse global institutions, take over government recommendations to advance their anti-dairy agendas. And the major global meeting that organization holds is the World Dairy Summit. It's a conference that takes place typically over 4 days, usually attended by roughly 1,000 people from 40-plus countries around the world. It's taking place during the week of October 16th in Chicago. That's the first time it'll be in the U.S. in 3 decades.
She says the World Dairy Summit's coming to the U.S. at a good time.
We had a record year in exports last year. We're very well poised to continue to grow in the years to come. And we're leading on so many of the sustainability fronts that are such an increasing focus for international markets and a lot of the other policymaking developments that our sector globally is working to contend with. Those attending are a pretty broad mix across the dairy industry. Normally, we see farmers, farmer organizations like cooperatives or farmer groups like those I represent on the National Milk Producers and U.S. Dairy Export Council side, a number of processing company representatives too, and then others throughout the supply chain. Take advantage while it's here in our backyard.
The summit will feature a wide variety of topics due to the number of issues the IDF is working on across the globe.
Things like looking at what the situation is of global dairy markets, views on some of the trade issues that are becoming contentious and how to deal with those better. Looking forward, taking a look at how we promote sustainability more effectively to today's global consumers. Also a number of things at the farm level side, such as how to provide farmers with more supports in advancing sustainability practices, how to make that more commercially effective for them, how to deal with heat stress issues. A lot of those attending are from both developed and developing countries, so it's a bit of a mix of topics to span that full spectrum.
Morris talks about where to find more information about the summit.
There's a website for the summit. Is probably the best place to go if you're interested in finding out more information, and that's at www.idfwds2023.com. You'd also find more information linked to it from the National Milk Producers Federation website or the U.S. Dairy Export Councils, so people can feel free to locate it that way as well.
Again, Shauna Morris of the National Milk Producers Federation and U.S. Dairy Export Council. Chad Smith reporting.
We're having a heat wave. Yes, songs about heat waves are one thing, but an actual heat wave is quite another. And during severe summer heat waves, local TV and radio stations always issue warnings to people about the dangers of the heat, talking about how we can protect ourselves by limiting outdoor activity, staying hydrated, wearing the right clothing, or just staying inside. So that's how you keep safe from heat stress and heat stroke. And of course, if you own a dog,
keeping yourself safe helps keep your pets safe too.
Or maybe vice versa. That's Agriculture Department veterinarian Dr. Dawn Fitzhugh. And she says if you take your pet for a walk or for outdoor playtime, you need to realize your dog may not be used to severe heat, could get into trouble very quickly. So if you need to take your dog for a walk during severe heat wave situations,
you want to do so early in the morning. Morning is generally when we find the coolest temperatures.
And Dawn says, be aware of just how hot sidewalks and streets can get. We've all heard variations on this astute observation.
You can fry an egg on that highway at noon.
And that's no joke when it comes to, like, blacktop surfaces.
Yes, dogs' paws and pads can be seriously, painfully burned by having to walk on streets and sidewalks on very hot days. As to the effects of very high air temperatures, though, Dawn says that for the most part, a dog's only way of dissipating heat is, that's right, panting. And that may not be enough to keep some dogs from becoming overheated and on the way to heat stroke and possibly death. So, Dawn says it's up to us to try to limit exposure to the heat, but also to watch for signs that the dog could be in trouble. If the dog's usually a big player, lots of running and lots of jumping and even walking for that matter, and then suddenly just stops and lies down,
then that's them telling you, hey, I've had enough here.
So if you can, get that dog back indoors where it's cooler, and
if you're able to put them in front of a fan, that works for them too. Just like fans help to cool us off, it does for them as well.
Offer the dog water from the faucet, not ice water. Soak some towels with water from the faucet and have the dog lie on that. However, let's go back a bit, back outside. The dog may not have stopped playing or walking on its own and could soon show other more serious signs of a heat problem. Things to look for?
A pet who is like lethargic.
Suddenly slow walking, may have trouble walking, staggering around, trying to walk.
Perhaps even vomiting. And some of the really significant things that can happen, they can have diarrhea that can even turn to bloody diarrhea. And so those things are an emergency. So that's where you want to get your dog to an emergency veterinarian.
And do it as quickly as possible. Better yet, avoid trouble for you and your pet and spend as little time outdoors in the severe heat as possible. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Today we have another episode of the Farm Side Chat, where American Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall gets to chat with Southern California avocado farmer Al Steely.
Welcome to the show, Al, and tell us a little bit about your farm there.
Well, thank you. And I have a small avocado farm in San Diego, North San Diego County, that my wife and I own. And I also have a management business where we manage avocado and citrus and wine grapes for other farmers.
Well, that's interesting. How long has your farm been in existence or in your family?
Since the early 60s, my father purchased the property here in San Diego County. 1960. And then I purchased it from him back in late 70s, early 80s. I can't remember exactly.
So most avocado?
Avocado, yeah. Either way, potato. Yeah.
So are most farms large or small that produces avocados? And where would you think you sit in that setting?
It's the average avocado farm is around 10 acres. I'm right in that niche. Mine is 60 acres, but only 7 of it is planted right now. I'm in the process of replanting with newer trees. So I got a ways to go to fill out the property.
Is it a fruit or a vegetable?
It's a fruit. It's a fruit.
Okay.
Yeah.
It has grown in popularity, I guess, over the last 5 or 6 years. And, you know, as a Georgia boy, I probably never heard of avocado until I got to be an adult. And now they're everywhere. My grandchildren actually suck them through some kind of cloth like a pacifier.
Yeah.
That I had never seen before until I had a grandchild. So tell me a little bit about that fruit and tell me a little bit about the popularity. Can you tell us why it has become so popular?
We take some credit for that. Our industry, a long time ago, we voted in a marketing order and we self-assess ourselves, the industry, for every pound we produce. And we do a lot of advertising. We do some research. So like any product, without advertising and getting information out there, people aren't going to know your product and aren't going to buy it. So I think we've been successful over the last 30, 40 years.
So Al, is that marketing order, is it considered a checkoff?
Yes. Yeah, it is. Because it's comes right off the bottom line at the packing house.
So, you know, we do something similar with beef, and I don't have to do it with chickens, but every cow I sell, I have to pay something into the checkoff or a marketing order. And there's a lot of critics around the country about checkoffs and marketing orders. But this fruit actually is a great example of what that those monies can produce for a producer.
When my dad and I first started in the business of raising avocados, the grower was getting 10 cents a pound. Right now, the price is $1.40 a pound to the grower. Of course, we would like to get a little bit more. You know, we're competing with imports and things like that. But on the bright side, the bad thing about imports is it's competing with, you know, California product. The good thing is it makes the avocado a year-round commodity, kind of like lettuce. It's always in the store from somewhere in the world. So people don't forget about us in the off season.
So there's a lot of avocado producers in California that also produce in Mexico. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are a few. They're more the big companies, like some of the packing houses have investments in Mexico. I don't have any desire to do that.
So does that fruit, I know it's a good thing that's on the shelf all the time, but does it also put downward pressure on your price?
It does. And so that's, you know, that's the two-edged sword of an import. But fortunately, we can carve out our season, and the imports come off or slow down in March and April. And so we have, you know, March, April through end of July, August, as pretty much solely California fruit.
You know, I hear that from other producers of like squash and bell peppers and strawberries, the pressure from outside the country on imports, the pressure is downward pressure on their price, and sometimes can be even less than cost of production because the rules and regulations in Mexico aren't as I don't want to say difficult, but we have more regulatory burdens on us in America than they do in other countries.
Yes, and for my product, avocados, you know, it's a native of Mexico, for example, and grows quite well there without irrigation. And so we have the expense of water and the labor that goes into that as well. So we have to be able to cover that. Yeah, you bring up a good point. A lot of growers are very frustrated having to compete with a foreign product that isn't under the same labor regulations that we are.
Yeah, we're one of the few industries in our country where the government, in some cases, tells us what we have to pay our workers, other than a minimum wage, of course, that we see all across the country.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in my area, President Duvall, the labor is so short that I don't know very many, if any, farmers that are paying minimum wage. You know, we're starting well above minimum wage just to compete and get reliable workers.
Right. Yeah. And labor is the biggest issue I've talked to farmers all across America. You wouldn't think it'd be a big issue in corn and soybean country, but it is. And so we look at it as one of the biggest problems we have in agriculture is labor.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'd love to talk about the fruit a little bit, because you might be surprised. Most people that listen to my podcast aren't farmers. Let me learn and let my listeners learn a little bit about the life of the avocado. When do you plant it? When do you harvest it? How much, you know, is it a big consumer of water or fertilizer? Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. So, yeah, we plant them. We try to plant in the spring, but pretty much we're in a warmer climate, frost-free generally, so we can plant anytime the trees or the labor is ready. I mean, we have the trees themselves are in short supply. We have to order over a year in advance. They're rather expensive. Each tree is up to $38 now. And then about 3 years later, we get our first fruit, not very many per tree. They're at maturity in about 5 years. They do take a lot of water and a fair amount of fertilizer, 100 pounds of nitrogen per year per acre, almost, you know, very similar to a lot of other crops. I primarily farm organic for the avocados, so we're using natural fertilizers, which are a lot more expensive than conventional fertilizer. But we can start harvesting avocados in November when they have enough oil in them. We can test that, and then we can harvest clear through September probably. So it's a long season. Avocados don't ripen till we pick them. So we can pick our markets. And normally I'll pick three or four times in each grove. We'll go through and pick the large ones, then go to another one, pick the large ones over there, and then come back and hopefully the smaller ones have grown. The price point for fruit that's 7.5 ounce and larger is what we're trying to go for. There's a big difference between 7.5 ounce fruit and 7 ounce fruit.
That was just a portion of their conversation. Visit fb.org for the full episode. Stay tuned. We'll have more ag news after the break.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The UC Grape Day is coming up next month in Parlier. The half-day event will take place at the Kearney Ag Research and Extension Center on Tuesday, August 8th. Trams for the field demonstration will begin boarding at 7:45 and will include presentations on chemical and rootstock choices for nematode management, rootstocks for salinity and drought stress in the San Joaquin Valley, and remote sensing of nitrogen in table grapes. Extension specialist with the Department of Viticulture and Enology at UC Davis, Matthew Fidelibus, will also be going over Sunpreme Raisin Grape performance. After the morning break, classroom presentations will include information on spray deposition and drift, along with rootstock effects on performance of young and mature Autumn King grapevines. 4 hours of DPR continuing education units have been requested for the event. More information about the UC Grape Day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
An acreage report shows just how flexible farmers can be. USDA's Gary Crawford has the report.
I'm a bit shocked.
Shocked. That was USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer's reaction right after seeing USDA's acreage report showing far more corn acres and far fewer soybean plantings than had been expected. But after studying the report, he went from shocked to this.
It is a bit of a surprise in terms of having these size acreage changes.
With a lot of soybean acres going to corn, but Meyer says it shows farmers being flexible as they consider things like prices and
expectations for prices. It might be fertilizer prices coming down in the spring and saying, hey, I can plant that corn, which uses a little bit more nitrogen fertilizer, and I'm not looking at the uncertainty and high prices I was looking at for the crop a year ago when they went into the field.
Meyer says the weather in many places made for an early planting season that also favored going with more corn or shifting some acres from beans to spring wheat, hay, and sorghum. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.